Seema Reza, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Of course. And I know that you are calling us from Maryland, correct?
That's right.
Awesome. I want to remind our listeners just briefly that this is the pandemic version of Words on a Wire. So we are recording actually from our own homes, me and my home here in El Paso and Seema and her home there in Maryland. And so if the sound quality kind of cuts in and out a little bit, just forgive us for some of that, but we will try and get the essence of Seema and her work and spirit across to you all anyway. So Seema, it's so great to see you and to talk with you again and to talk about this new book you have, which came out last year, but I still, like all your books, even your first book, When the World Breaks Open, this is almost like a little embarrassing confession maybe, but I still read, I read it all the time. I still crack open your work and read it. And sometimes I'll text you and be like, oh my God, this is like changing my life in this moment, you know, because I'm not even just saying it. Like, it's genuinely, your work just blows me away. And it stays with me for such a long period of time afterward. And so when I was reading these poems, I've been reading them over the last year, and it's just, it does the same to me. It makes me want to write. It makes me want to think differently about the way I live. It's just some really great stuff. So congratulations first on the second book.
Thank you so much. And thanks for all those words, especially it makes me want to write, you know?
Oh yeah.
You want to write things that invite people.
For sure. And I should mention the title, actually, the book is called A Constellation of Half Lives, and it's published with A Right Bloody Book. And that's right. This is your second book. Is that right?
Yes.
Awesome. And so I have like a lot of questions, but before we get into them, why don't you share one of the poems from the book?
Absolutely. This poem is called Fortune. And it's the one that I wasn't sure I was gonna put in until the end. So, Fortune. I'm not supposed to know what it means to pass someone the AK. I'm not supposed to know that sometimes people get killed because we all look alike, and retaliation does not always require accuracy. I am an American civilian. I am absolutely not supposed to know how often a child holding a gun, or a child holding a cell phone, or a child holding a long string attached to a paper kite rocking in the sky is shot and killed in my name. I'm not supposed to know that there's no way out of this, that 4,000 more troops is the integer, some undetermined number is the exponent, and the figure represents nightmares per night on Earth. I'm not supposed to know that the Afghan boy he shot on his last deployment, the one that brought him spinning into my life, looked just like my son, but smaller and less lucky. And his mother, who is less lucky than me, must know all these things too.
And if you're just tuning in with us, that's the voice of Maryland-based poet and memoirist, Seema Reza. Seema, thank you. That's, like all your work, a very heavy poem. Can you tell me a little bit about that poem? What inspired that?
Yeah, so that poem was written from a prompt of I'm Not Supposed to Know, given to me by Susanna Sonnenberg at the Fine Art Work Center. I was studying with her. And if you ever have a chance to take a class with her, she just cuts you right open.
Nice.
And I started to think about, you know, for many years I've done this work in the military health system, leading poetry workshops with service members, mostly service members and veterans though, dealing with post-traumatic stress related to service, but also related to living on this wrecked planet, right?
Right.
But particularly the things that have to do with what my tax dollars, what's being done in my name by my government and by the men and women who sign up to protect us. Just like I started to think about like all the things that I know that I, as an American civilian, am not supposed to know, and that are so completely, plainly clear to the people in those countries that our troops are deployed to.
Right. I imagine, well, I actually know because we've had many conversations about your writing as well and your work that you've been doing there for a long time now. But, you know, how much of that really has an impact in your writing? You know, how much of it informs your writing, you know, the work that you're doing there with, is it still considered the Wounded Warriors Project or is it under a different organization? Or I don't...
So our organization is Community Building Artworks. Wounded Warrior Project is another nonprofit. I think they're moving away from the name within the military of Wounded Warriors.
Okay.
But they're wounded, ill, injured, transitioning.
Right, right. And you lead, and you've been leading these writing workshops with them and sort of these various types of workshops with them for years now, right?
Yeah, for a decade.
Right, for a decade. Wow, yeah. Because I mean, all of that really does, you know, just comes through in this book and even your previous book also. But the way that you're able to, I think, I don't want to use the word mine because it feels like such a just an intrusive word, but maybe the way you're able to sort of extract the nutrients and the value from those exchanges you have with this community, and then apply that into your writing, you know, into your own life. So it feels like it feels very intimate, your writing, but it feels also like you're applying the what you're learning into your life and then through that filtering that into the poems.
I think that's a really great way to say it. I think what it is that I lead these workshops just because somebody's got to be called the leader, but really I'm learning in them as much. It's right. These are spaces in which, and I, you know, I've led workshops within detention centers, on cancer wards, and in all of these places where people are like flayed open and are done with the mask.
Right.
You're invited if you choose to take that invitation as a outsider, as a leader of a workshop in those spaces, you're invited then to take your mask off too.
Right.
And to examine like these deep pools of overlap that exist in different kinds of grief. You know, it's regret right. And it's all the stuff that's familiar to me.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it makes me think, I know for myself personally, when I'm exploring a subject in my books, that really the reason is that I have so many questions, about my own existence. I'm led by this sense of wanting to discover, what the source of that is, what the cure for that is. I want to discover, and I never have answers. They're just questions. Is that kind of what you're talking about here? Is that what you're also, do you feel like you're doing that?
Yeah, totally never have answers. And I love this idea of like, I'm seeking a cure for myself as well. And you know, when I started this work, maybe a few months into the work, certainly less than a year after I started at the old Walter Reed Army Medical Center, my father died very suddenly. He drowned in the ocean and we weren't speaking at the time. And I felt alone and awash and my marriage was falling apart. And, you know, When the World Breaks Open is about that time.
Yeah.
And being in these communities at Walter Reed and then later at Fort Belvoir Community Hospital as well, which is another military installation in the area. It saved my life as much as anyone will tell you that my workshop saved theirs, right? Because to have spaces where we can be like, is it normal to feel this way?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like so essential.
It is. It is absolutely essential. And you know, I know, and you mentioned your previous book, which is a memoir. Although I would argue written very much and structured like poetry as well. It's a beautiful memoir. And like I said, it actually came to me at a time in my life too, where things were just upside down and it just was really, it helped sort of light the path a little bit, for what I was enduring at that time as well. But you know, there's this incredible, wait, can you hear me? Can you hear me okay? Okay. There's this incredible level that you reach this level of intimacy that you write, that you accomplish in your writing in that previous book. And then when I first heard that this book, Constellation of Half Lives, was coming out and it was poetry, I was just kind of, I was really curious as a fan of your other book. I was really curious as a fan of your memoir, like what she's going to do with the poems. And, obviously did not disappoint. But you also access that same degree and depth of just, of, you know, of intimacy, of real hard truth, of all of that is, are in these poems as well. Is that, now this might sound like a really kind of a fluffy question, but it's also something that I'm always curious to know myself, you know, is that easy for you to do? Or is that something that, like, to craft one of these poems, just one, does it take you weeks or months to process before you're able to feel like you can release it into the world?
Oh, I mean,
what's
you
the
know
process,
how it,
basically?
Yeah. You know how it is, right? Like, in, by the time I sit down with the pen, I've been thinking about this thing for so long, right? I've been trying not to write it oftentimes for so long, or writing drafts of it in my head as I, like, ride the bus, or, you know, whatever, back when people rode the bus were able to, there was somewhere to go. But yeah, like, so some poems, of course, come, like, fully formed, like, you know, like Athena from Zeus's head, just like, oh, there it is. But many of the poems, I'll start as, like, prose, and then I'm like, no, that's not right. And then I'll, you know, like, so I'll switch form back and forth. So I guess that was a long way to say sometimes.
Right. You know, let me ask you a little bit more about that, the idea of switching forms, because the way you spoke about it right now, the way you speak of it, it feels kind of that you allow the process, the subject, to organically find its form versus you imposing a form on it. Like, today I'm going to write a poem about X. It's more like I'm going to just, there's a subject and you're going to put it, commit it to words, and then let that determine the form. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it takes, like, multiple passes. I'll be trying to, like, stretch something into an essay because I wanted to write an essay about this thing. And really, I just needed this one sentence. Like, there is a poem in here that's basically just a sentence that I had been, it was in an essay and it didn't belong in the essay. And I thought, well, maybe I need to write more about it. But actually, it just needed to be lifted and let breathe, you know?
I do know. What would you share that one with us?
Yes, absolutely. It is called, I'm looking for it, sorry. It's called, it has a long title in quotes. If Baba gets remarried, it's really over between the two of you. My son cups the glowing wick of a candle already blown out and calls it light.
Yes. Yes. I just read that this morning, that exact one. And I was like, I'm going to ask her about it. So I'm glad it just came up on its own. But if you're just tuning in with us right now, we're talking with Maryland-based poet and memoirist Sima Reza. About her new book, A Constellation of Half Lives, came out with A Right Bloody Book. And then you have this whole section titled Reckoning with Impermanence that is a lot of reflections too about your father as well, about your family. How did that come about, that section?
Yeah, so that's actually a crown of sonnets.
Yeah, that's right.
And when my son was 16, right before When the World Breaks Open, we took that drive on Route One, mm-hmm. you know?
I did.
And it was one of the most beautiful times. And I just felt like this grief. And I thought, gosh, why are beautiful things, why do they make me so sad? Why does looking at my child sleep make me so heart-filled and maddeningly sad?
Yeah,
it's like, or even listening to beautiful music, but this impermanence. And I was like, how could I possibly write anything, any poem about this? And I was introduced to the idea of a crown of sonnets in a workshop I took with Dinesh Smith. And I was like, okay, this is a form where I could sit with this idea and see what it has.
Can you just briefly explain for our listeners what a crown of sonnets is?
A crown of sonnets is a group of 15 sonnets in which the last line of the first sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet, and so on and so forth. And then the jewel in the crown, which I did not do, is comprised of just all of those last line, first lines. Right. So it's a crown without a jewel.
what's the symbolism behind that? It's for another book.
Circle, you know? Yeah, that's by my next book to find out.
Totally. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing to see, to read A Crown of Sonnets. It's a beautiful thing to look at. It's just a beautiful work of art because it's also extremely difficult to do. I think I attempted one a few years ago and I just gave up at the second one. I was like, wait a minute, I got to connect the what? It felt like math to me.
But, yeah. But,
anyways, no, it's a beautiful work from that piece in particular. You also have another section, and I want to kind of walk tenderly around this, but it's a section called the Khadija poems that appear. And I know that you had previously mentioned, you know, working, it was a real exchange with someone that these poems, I guess, are based on. What was the impetus for that? And then also, what's the tender process of writing poems based on others' lives?
Yeah, I mean, so the Khadija poems, they're written to an imagined, though not quite fictional, woman living on the other side of the global war on terror, which of course our country is still engaged in.
Right.
And I had been imagining this woman, Khadija, really from early on in doing this work, because so often the really big traumatic combat events that service members who come home and are grappling with how to live have to do with the death of children, you know? Sometimes witnessing it, sometimes being responsible for it. And I would think again and again, you know, my sons are both my ex-husband is from sort of North India, and my sons both look like pretty Middle Eastern, right? My younger son looks very Afghani. My older son looks pretty Iraqi, actually. And sometimes people would even have pictures of the kids, you know, because they've been kids in the neighborhood where the base was or that they'd seen on patrol.
Right.
And I kind of touched on that in that first poem that I shared. And I kept thinking, like, what is their mother doing, right? Like, what are the mothers of these kids doing while I'm sitting here comforting, you know, the people who I imagine she holds responsible.
Right.
I wrote her letters, and instead of guessing what she thought, the beauty of an epistle is that it was a letter. So I just asked her, okay, what do you think about this?
Would you mind sharing one of those poems with us?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
There's this sort of peppered throughout. Yeah. And I'm looking for one that's not too long.
Yeah, and you're welcome to even read a section of one if you'd like. I like the Unspecial Women, the one on page 23.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll read the last section of that one.
Okay. All right.
Four. I am soft, bending, addicted to comfort I've done nothing to deserve. I'm a kind woman, pretty, unspecial, cruel, impatient, unforgiving, entitled, and swaggering, an American, faced with violence, I am certain I would surrender immediately. Except on ordinary days, when the children kick one another under the table and the air conditioner and oven are running at once, I cannot convince myself that you were not here yesterday, that I could not be there tomorrow.
Wonderful. And this is poet and memoirist Sima Reza, who is reading from her book, Constellation, A Constellation of Half Lives. And that was from one of the Dear Khadija poems. I wanted to ask you actually about in the afterword, which is it's a beautiful afterword. I return to that also. As a writer, sometimes, you know, we have to, as you know, but I'm speaking to the listeners out there, as writers, you know, we often find support and even solace and comfort even in reading the process that other writers go through, the thought process in terms of, you know, where their writing fits in the world, why they're doing that. Because, you know, the truth is, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a privilege and a beautiful thing to write, which we all can do, but it's also a very, you know, solitary process. And sometimes you don't know. And then when you're trying to construct poems or prose for a reader that'll be published one day, it's really kind of a feeling of like, am I wasting my time doing this, or am I doing this for something? And who is it for, this imagined, right? Yeah. And so you writing this essay and including that at the back, first, why don't you, before I ask you my question about it, why don't you tell me a little bit about what, you know, where that came from, the essay in the back, why you wrote that one?
So I had delivered it as the commencement speech for my master's program. Mm-hmm. My class, my little class at Goddard Graduate Institute, asked me to give that speech. And I'd been thinking a lot about that dream. It opens with this scene that's this dream that I really had, where there was a monster knocking on my door, and my bedroom door, and I tried to close the door, and I couldn't hold the door closed. I couldn't hold the monster away. And when I opened the door, it was a little monster, but very scary. And I thought, there's no way I can defeat this monster. I had nothing, right? I'm not very strong. And I didn't have any weapons. And I thought, gosh, all I can do is be kind. And so, you know, in the dream, I took the monster into my little kitchen and fed her a banana, and the nicest banana I had, in a glass of milk. And as she drank the milk and ate the banana, she became an ordinary girl, just a regular kid. I am not a naturally kind person, you know?
I don't know about that, but...
I'm not. I'm petty, and I'm, you know, like, I have a temper and I'm snide and all of these things. And I work really hard at being kind, you know? And I don't know if it's because it's the stronger weapon that I have. And, you know, weapon meaning stronger tool to enact change. But that has been something really orienting for me. Like, what should I do now? Be kinder. You know, no matter, when faced with a situation that I feel like, how do I get through to this person? Maybe I don't. Maybe I'm just kinder.
And you mentioned then, because that is based on a dream that you're talking about, but one of the things you say in that essay is that you tend to work out a lot of your, you know, I guess, life through your dreams. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. You know, I think, like, when I get out of my own way, I'm able to know what the essential is. And then there's the second work of, like, then trusting it. And it's been a long, an incomplete, whatever, backwards, looping back on itself kind of road of trusting myself. Right. But I think that there are things that happen when our brain is not observed, right? Like, there's the two minds. There's my mind, and then there's the apperception, right? Like, me observing that. And when the observing mind is kind of like moved a little bit away. I think that's where you really know what you know. And dreams, when you remember them, are an opportunity.
They are. Yeah, absolutely. I do feel the same way too. Although I don't dream very often. And when I do, sometimes it's like, sometimes I feel better served to just let it go than to hang on and, you know, sometimes like work over it. Yeah. I've been told many times by different people who, you know, that I should probably spend some time with the dreams, you know, but I'm always like, no, it's like, but, you know, it's no, just,
say it, more. It, what do you mean? Why no?
I don't know. You know, it's like, I think because for me, there are so many, awake experiences that I still have yet to unpack. And I feel like they're piling up on my bookshelves, just like all the new books I have that I haven't read, you know?
And I do.
Oh, you do. And so part of me feels like before I begin to unpack, I'm even able to unpack the dream state, the dream stories. I still have work to do here. Not that that's not here. That is a part of here, but I think so. I think that's where it's coming from, more like almost a feeling of being overwhelmed by rich stories that I have to unpack, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I feel like, you know, so we've talked a little bit about When the World Breaks Open, which was the memoir, right. And it's not in order because I feel like I didn't understand those things in linear order. And right now I'm working on a whole bunch of stuff, writing about girlhood and coming of age and thinking like, oh, I needed all of these things in between then and now, and then whatever happened today, to understand this thing that happened when I was six, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think dreams give us that like freedom from the timeline.
I agree. They absolutely do. And I think I understand what you're saying by that as well. There are things that, you know, years ago when I was an undergraduate student at Naropa, I remember, I think it was Anne Waldman. I might be wrong, but I think it was her who was talking about as poets taking on a kind of life work, a life body of work, something that we would investigate for the rest of our lives and continue to work on. And I just kind of, at that moment, when I heard her say that, I remember thinking to myself, well, isn't that what we can consider all our body of work, you know, like a life's work, because they're constantly in conversation with one another, you know? I think she was talking about something a little more intentional, but I still felt that and that there are stories that I tried unpacking in poetry 20 years ago. And only now have I come to a place after having written them 3 or 4 times that now I realize, oh, it's actually a book of prose that I have been trying to explore, you know, and yeah. We continue to kind of, experience in time and practice continues to inform the way we think and rethink some of these things, you know, So you touched quickly on, we're running out of time already, but you touched quickly on what's coming up. That's what I wanted to ask you. So what do you have next?
Oh, what's man, I've been like, really, this, like some people have been having a great time creatively through this time. I have not. I've been reading a lot, but I've just sort of this week have started to feel close in on, oh, I'm writing memoir. I don't know if it's essay or long form, like whether it's essays or long form, but about sexuality and patriarchy in the South Asian Muslim diaspora. So like this sort of how we deal with abuse and body shame and all these things and how they shape us to both desire and loathe men, you know? Like leading them from behind, praying behind them, but then also having to put up with, you know, like it's just this whole complicated thing. And now as the mother of sons, right. I'm like, oh no, men are just as complex, you know, which sounds silly. I'm almost 40 to say this, but really I feel like there was a lot of training in me to keep me on my toes around men that my mother, you know, wanted to keep me safe, I think.
Right.
And just so,
unpacking that and working on that. Nice. Well, of course, we look forward to everything that you write. I look forward to everything that you write. And I know our listeners do too. And I think we're out of time. And I just want to say it's been a pleasure talking with you. It always is.
It always is. Thank you so much for having me. And maybe next time you and I just start a podcast about the books we didn't finish.
I think that's a great idea.
And we'll just like ask listeners to tell us what happened at the end because we started another book.
That's exactly what we're going to do.
Crowdsourcing. Oh, man.
That's exactly it. Oh my God. That's right. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, Seema, and you know, congratulations on everything and all the work you're doing, all the workshops that you're offering virtually right now too. Just keep all that great stuff coming.
I will for sure. Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.